Up first, though, we are happy to welcome back to the program a journalist and author who's written some terrific books about television history, including Seinfeldia, Mary and Lou, and Rhoda and Ted, When Women Invented Television, and her brand new book, So Fetch, The Making of Mean Girls, and Why We're Still So Obsessed with It. We're happy to welcome back to the program Jennifer Cation Armstrong. Jennifer, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you for having me.
My goodness, you do such a wonderful job in your books at taking these shows or films that we know so well and making them seem new to us in the way you tell the story behind the story.
Thank you. That is exactly what I'm trying to do.
Well, mission accomplished there. And the story of Mean Girls, which is such a fascinating one, really begins not with Tina Fey, but with an author named Rosalind Wiseman.
Yes, exactly. It's actually really interesting. This is based on a parenting manual, essentially, for parents of teen girls that was called Queen Bees and Wannabes. And it was actually quite a sensation when it came out in the early 2000s, which is how, of course, Tina Fey heard about it and wanted to adapt it, and it eventually became Mean Girls.
And her goal for the film was, I think she referred to it as a more hopeful Heathers.
That's right, which I love, because Heathers is quite dark. I did rewatch it for this, and I was, you know, even though having seen it before, I was like, oh, that's right, it really is quite dark. So it has a real kind of, like, you know, optimistic ending, essentially, that these kinds of issues can be overcome, whereas Heathers was mostly about blowing up the school instead.
Well, she got the help of SNL producer Lorne Michaels, but different than some of the other SNL spinoffs, because they have not all been very successful when it comes to movies, but she had a lot more creative control in this one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this, of course, is not one of those other ones where it was kind of like based on a sketch that was really popular, and then they do it for 2 hours, and you're like, oh, this isn't as much fun at 2 hours. This was kind of this fresh new material from that Rosalind Wiseman book, and I think that was really smart. She also didn't put herself at the center of this movie, which I think is, you know, very different from a lot of previous stars becoming movie stars in this way. She kind of wrote this actually really smart and funny script and let a lot of other people shine, which I think is interesting and very generous.
Well, and it sounds like a real key was getting the services of Mark Waters as director, a guy who had done Freaky Friday before. He had worked with Lindsay Lohan, and it seems like he created just a great environment on the set.
He really did. I have never, very rarely have I heard more people say more nice things about a person in Hollywood than I heard these people who were in this cast. And it was a lot of young people. You know, it's not just that main cast, but everyone playing the high schoolers. If you think about it, this is dozens and dozens and dozens of kids who were essentially in their teens and 20s playing teenagers. And that can be hard because most of them were quite inexperienced, and he made it fun. He would do a lot of takes so that he would, you know, just keep rolling and have them kind of loosen up and play and have a really good time. And everyone just said, and you can see it in the final product, right? You know, the best directing often doesn't announce itself. I think it's just like goes down really smooth. And this is a tightly edited, beautifully made, everyone at the top of their game film.
What's in a name? I'm not sure the movie would have had the resonance it has if it had stuck with its original title.
Yes, the original title was Homeschooled, which, you know, refers to its main character, Katie Heron, who was homeschooled and then comes into this public high school and kind of has to deal with the cliques. But they eventually decided to change the name and went with Mean Girls, which was actually part of a headline that was on a story about Rosalind Wiseman that kind of caught Tina Fey's attention to begin with in the New York Times Magazine. And it just sums it up perfectly if you think about it. And it's like something that we now use as a phrase. And I think that's key to its longevity is that, you know, you'll say things like, oh, you know, my daughter's dealing with a mean girl situation at school or that kind of thing. And I think, you know, this is one of those situations where having that super straightforward, no-nonsense title worked so well.
Well, teen comedies have been around forever, but I feel like this was certainly one of the first, if not the first, to look at the experience of being a teenager and going to high school through the eyes of young women.
Exactly. I mean, in this very specific way, right, that feels very rooted and real, and it's about their relationships with each other and not about, you know, a boy. There is a boy situation, but I feel like the boy is so much of just kind of a pawn for, you know, the two main characters, Regina and Katie. And that, to me, is what's so unique about this. You know, I watched it with some current sixth through eighth graders last year and asked them about it, and they were very focused on the friendships. And I said, what about the boy? And they were like, who? Like, they weren't even that interested in him. It was like, really, the resonant part here is about the girls' friendships and the extreme intricacies of them.
The story of the casting of the film is fascinating, and really everything they went through to find the perfect person to play Regina George.
Yes, they really, you know, they had a lot of young women around the same age range, and then it just became, you know, I believe the casting director, Marcy Leroff, said to me, it became kind of like a chess game. You know, they were like moving everyone around the board. And at first, Lindsay Lohan actually came in and wanted to play Regina. And that was kind of, she really wanted that if she was going to star. And they had to kind of talk her into playing essentially the main character, Katie, who goes through more of an arc and is kind of more of that like likable one that you follow through. And they said, you know, you're the star, you're the one everyone loves, you have to do this. And so from there, they had Rachel McAdams, who had actually read for the role of Katie. And she had been told she was too old. She was 25 at the time. And they thought, so what if we bring her back in for this extremely dominant character, Regina George? Maybe it makes sense that she's 25 in that case, right? Because, you know, I don't know. I feel like I always had a girl in my high school who was like, you know, seemed kind of like she was 25, right? And she was kind of a Regina George. So that was the real key. And then seeing her with Lindsay Lohan, Mark Waters actually said, you know, I've worked with Lindsay before. She has such a strong personality. I've never seen her intimidated, but she was a little intimidated when she met this older girl, Rachel McAdams, to read with her. And he loved that dynamic for these characters. And that was where it really came together. But also Amanda Seyfried, who ends up playing the ditzy role of Karen, had been in strong contention for the Regina character. And in fact, Lauren Michaels, who you mentioned before, was producer on this. He actually preferred her for the role, but he was outvoted.
And then finding someone to play the role of Damien was so important, and particularly to Tina Fey, since he was based on a friend of hers.
That's right. Damien Holbrook is the real Damien in real life. He's a TV guide writer now, and so lovely. And he grew up with her, and they did theater together in their teens. And he's very strongly based on basically Damien and Damien's brother, who they, you know, all grew up together. And I think she had an extra hard time because this was emotional, you know, and it's like she had this very clear vision for him. And Daniel Francese, who ended up playing him, did come in and read for the role, and everyone loved him in the waiting room. Super charming in the waiting room, and they thought, this is going to be it, you know. And then when they went into the actual casting room, maybe he got nervous or whatever, you know, things happen in auditions, and they were like, oh, that wasn't quite what we had hoped for. But when they kept looking and didn't find anyone, they actually asked him to come out to the table read. They had cast everyone else, and they had him come out, fly out to the table read in Los Angeles.
And that was crazy, too, because they had him come to the table read. Everybody else had their parts, and he didn't have it yet.
That's right. So that was essentially his audition, which you can imagine how nerve-wracking that might have been. However, Mark Waters said, I guess, you know, Daniel really understood the assignment and understood the stakes. And he said he really came to play there. He said he played Damien like it was a movie about Damien, and that's what they loved. And he had people laughing out loud the whole time. And if you've seen the movie, you know that, of course he did, because he has some of the best lines. And he just, Mark Waters said, once he did that table read, he was so locked into the character that Mark didn't really even have to give him notes later on in the filming. It was just, he got it in that moment. That was the critical moment.
We're talking with Jennifer Cation Armstrong about her new book, So Fetch, The Making of Mean Girls and Why We're Still So Obsessed With It. The movie was filmed in Canada, and I love the stories in the book about the Canadian kids who were brought in to play the other students.
You may have picked up on it. I love that. It's some of my favorite stuff that, you know, there were all of these people who were late teens, early 20s. They all knew each, not all, but a lot of them knew each other because they were all in Toronto, you know, aspiring actors, all going to the same auditions. They had all, auditioned for Degrassi at one point or the other, which is a huge Canadian show. And they just, I think that lent it an extra feeling of like, this is a high school, you know, because they actually did know each other and got to hang out on the set a lot. And they were divided into little cliques and really had that feeling of it. And they all had this strange feel, you know, strange afterlife of the movie as well, where each of them got, you know, kind of these one or two great lines to say in the movie that later became quite famous. And so because of Tina Fey's amazing script and because she was so generous with those jokes, they all got kind of a moment in that movie.
And when it comes to moments, I think maybe my favorite story in the book is the story of the actor who played Glenn Coco, who's not even billed and, as you pointed out, didn't even get paid.
That's right. This is such a great, it goes with what I was just saying, right? It's so sort of casual and everybody knows each other. He had a bunch of friends on the movie. He had auditioned and didn't get a role, but he lived across the street from where they were filming. And so he kind of knew because of his friends. And he thought, I'm going to go over and say hi to them and maybe cop some food from the craft services table, because he was a starving actor at the time. He was like 19 years old. And so he went over and did that. And as he was doing that, Mark Waters came by and like pointed at him and said, "Hey, you." And he thought, "Oh my God, I'm in trouble. I've been found out." And instead, Mark said, "I have a role for you. It has a name and everything." And so they whisked him off to wardrobe, gave him a second shirt because he was going to be in two scenes. So he wore his own in one and theirs in another. And, you know, if you watch the Glenn Coco scene where he gets the four candy cane grams, you only see really the back of his head, but you can kind of see more of him if you're paying a lot of attention. He's sitting in front of Gretchen Wieners in the scene where she gives a report in English class about Julius Caesar and kind of compares Julius Caesar to Regina. So those were his two scenes. He never signed a contract, never got credit, you know, never had a credit, never was hired, and he kind of went on with his life. And it wasn't until Mean Girls took on a new life online about 10 years later that the internet essentially cross-referenced him with, he continued to act and people figured out that it was him, having seen him on shows like Suits, and figured out who this actor was. And kind of, you know, he started being recognized. He has embraced it since. His name is David Rial and is just a lovely guy. And he kind of gets a kick out of the fact that he is this, you know, catchphrase for the ages. Even though he had zero lines in the movie, he is still, I mean, people get so excited when I talk about Glenn Coco now.
Well, and the whole social media aspect is I think every bit as fascinating as the making of the film, because, you know, otherwise, without social media and the internet, people remember Mean Girls as this really terrific film that captured the zeitgeist of that moment in time. But then along comes social media, along comes the age of the meme, and now Mean Girls is everywhere.
Exactly. It just was a strange coincidence, essentially, of timing, that it comes along right around, you know, it captures millennials' hearts, essentially, when they're teenagers. And then a little while later, memes and GIFs are invented, and millennials are the ones who really knew how to make them from the beginning. I mean, they were literally being hired by major media companies because they knew how to make memes and GIFs. And what did they reach for but this movie that they loved so much? It is also very meme and GIFable, right? It is great to look at, and it has all of these one-liners that Tina Fey wrote. And so, you know, these memes just proliferated, and people will reach for them in any number of situations now. It's like, you know, when it could be anything. There was one story of, you know, the Met Ball, which is where often, like, celebrities are walking the red carpet with really weird outfits on. And this actor named Jonathan Malin, who had this line when there's a meltdown at school and he calls his mom and says, "Mom, can you come and get me? I'm scared." That was being used everywhere. You know, when
even Hillary Clinton dropping one.
That's right. That's right. When Donald Trump kind of taunted her when she said she wasn't going to run again, he said something like, "Oh, well, I'm so sorry, I can't run against her," that kind of thing. When he was still on Twitter, he said this on Twitter, and her response was just, Regina George saying, "Why are you so obsessed with me?" So there you go.
Well, and then the fascinating story of the trip to Broadway that apparently began with Tina Fey hearing that people were doing their own sort of little improvised takes on the film, and she said, I don't want somebody else getting their hands on this. If it's going to be a play, I want it to be my play.
That's right. I loved that she had said that she was hearing that, like, college kids were doing it. And I think she also really harbored latent Broadway dreams, and this was really her big moment. And her husband is a songwriter, so all of those factors are important as well. And I think she kind of had it in the back of her head anyway, and then she hears this, so she just thought, all right, we're going to go for it. And I do think that this second life on the internet gave that a lot of steam too, because, you know, this doesn't happen till the 2010s. This doesn't happen till more than 10 years after the movie. So it's not like an immediate, like, oh, how can we capitalize on it? It was more like, oh, people are still talking about this. People are more into it than ever. Why not make a musical? And so she was able to team up with her husband and, of course, some others and make the musical on Broadway, which was quite successful.
And I love the fact that she was able to update the musical and correct some things that they didn't feel great about in the original version. And then she talked about, where is this musical going to be in 10 years? How do we write something that will be as timeless as a musical can be?
That's right. And, you know, it is kind of a nice do-over, right? Because it's not a straight-up reboot. And, you know, there were things, as many things in 2004, there's some stuff in there that was, you know, stuff we wouldn't say now. And so they were able to kind of update that. They were able to incorporate social media more, which obviously became much more of a factor in the time since Mean Girls, and of course would be a huge factor in teen girls' lives. And you've seen it, you know, yet again now with the musical movie in theaters. It's so hard to parse this all out, but now that they've made a movie of the musical, they were able to kind of update, do another round of updates, and incorporate things like TikTok.
Yeah, and it's been such a journey, and I know I'm trying to remember the other film, obviously The Producers, but there haven't been many films that have gone this route of film to Broadway musical and then to film musical.
That's right. It's basically the Producers and Hairspray are what I'm aware of.
There you go.
That have done that, yeah.
Well, I teach high school, and so you know, working with high school students, seeing. And what made it work is the reality of it, the way kids talk to each other and about each other. I thought the casting of the SNL people as the adults, but not being the focus and not being over-the-top characters was a stroke of genius as well.
Completely, and that's a funny one because at first the studio didn't want it because they thought, like, oh, these other SNL-related movies haven't done that well. But they were so kind of, you know, they were able to do such a great job with these smaller roles and just really let the kids shine, but kill it when they were, you know, especially if you think of someone like Amy Poehler playing Regina's mom. Like, they are just incredible, and they, you know, the director didn't really have to worry about them, and he could just focus on the kids.
So what has given this film, and now Broadway show, and now film again, what's given it these legs to make it not just hang around for 20 years, but to grow in popularity and add new generations of fans?
Well, I think it's a lot of what we have talked about here, but the biggest thing, and I think nothing else, none of the other stuff works if this part isn't true, which is just that there is a universal truth at the center that kind of doesn't go away. We wish it would. We wish people could just get along, right, and not have these issues. We wish we had a race to the mall. But, you know, I think the reason that it sticks is because this really had a truth at its center that we all deal with, not just teen girls. You know, it's like we all have moments in our lives where we wish we were part of the in-group and we would do almost anything to get there. And we deal with difficult people. So we were just talking about, you know, even in national politics, this comes up all the time. So I think that part is what makes it last. And then, of course, if, you know, you have to have the other parts as well, which is that it's so much fun. It's beautiful to look at. It's perfectly made and paced and everything else. It has all of these lines that we go back to over and over. And then it's sort of omnipresent because of these memes that have been, you know, flying around the internet for the last 10 or 15 years. So all of that together makes it almost feel like, you know, it just came out. And I mean, now it has in musical form, but before that even, it just sort of felt like this timeless thing. And I was told over and over again, and it's true, that, you know, girls were just kind of like watching this as a rite of passage at their 12th birthdays. It's like, 12th birthday comes, you got to watch Mean Girls at the slumber party. That's just how it is.
Well, and who doesn't want their tormentor from high school to meet the same fate as Regina?
Just a light bus accident.
Like, right.
Light bus accident. No lasting damage. She was playing lacrosse at the end.
Well, it is Wednesday, so we're wearing pink today in honor of this conversation, Jennifer. The book is an absolute delight. It reminds us what we love about the film and what we love about telling a story that's true and relates to so many people. So congratulations on another wonderful book, So Fetch, The Making of Mean Girls and Why We're Still So Obsessed with It.
Thank you so much.
Great talking with you again, Jennifer. Thank you.
All right.
That's Jennifer Cation Armstrong with us here on Downtown. We'll take a break.